This call is being recorded.
Shango, moju baile, Shango, oni walo, eri jaja, ori shako, eru male, Shango.
People use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
I'm speaking as a black man from America, which is a racist society. No matter how much you hear it talk about democracy, it's as racist as South Africa, or as racist as Portugal, or as racist as any other racialist society on this earth. The only difference between it and South Africa preaches separation and practices separation. America preaches integration and practices segregation. This is the only difference. They don't practice what they preach. Whereas South Africa preaches and practices the same thing. I have more respect for a man who lets me know where he stands, even if he's wrong, than the one who comes up like an angel and is nothing but a devil. There are 16 senatorial committees that govern the country and 20 congressional committees. 10 of the 16 senatorial committees are in the hands of Southern racialists, senators who are racialists. 13 of the 20, about this was before the last election. I think it's even more so now. 10 of the 16 committees, senatorial committees, are in the hands of senators who are Southern racialists. 13 of the 20 congressional committees were in the hands of Southern congressmen who are racialists, which means out of the 36 committees that govern the foreign and domestic direction of that government, 23 are in the hands of Southern racialists, men who in no way believe in the equality of man, and men who do anything within their power to see that the black man never gets to the same seat or to the same level that they are on. The reason that these men from that area have that type of power is because America has a seniority system. And these who have that seniority have been there longer than anyone else because the black people in the areas where they live can't vote. And it is only because the black man is deprived of his vote that puts these men in positions of power that gives them such influence in the government beyond their actual intellectual or political ability, or even beyond the number of people from the areas that they represent. So we can see in that country that no matter what the federal government professes to be doing, the power of the federal government lies in these committees, and any time a black man or any kind of legislation is proposed to benefit the black man or give the black man his just due, we find that it's locked up in these committees right here. And when they let something through the committee, usually it is so chopped up and fixed up that by the time it becomes law, it's a law that can't be enforced.
Well, just as in World War II, this country could use its news media to propagandize and make the whole American public love the Germans and the Japanese, rather love the Russians and the Chinese and hate the Germans and the Japanese. And then after the war, they changed it and made the American public love the Germans and love the Japanese, hate the Russians and hate the Chinese, which shows that they can make the American public love whom they will and hate whom they will. And that same process can be used to re-educate the American public and show white people how to love black people and show black people how to do something to stand on our own feet and solve our own problems. The black man doesn't have to be taught to love the white man. The white man has to be taught to love the black man.
But
I was invited to address.
If man is the father, the sun is the center of the earth, in the middle of the universe, then why is this verse coming 6 times rehearsed? Don't freestyle much, but I write them like such.
Word.
Amongst the fiends controlled by the screens, what does it all mean, all this I'm seeing? Human beings screaming vocal javelins, sign of a local unraveling.
Uh-huh.
My wandering got my wondering, with crisis and all this crisis. Hating Satan never knew what nice is. Check the papers, well, I bet on ISIS. More than your eye can see and ears can hear. Year by year, all the sense disappears. Nonsense perseveres, prayers laced with fear. Beware, 2 triple O's.
It might feel good, it might sound a little something. But damn the game, if it don't mean nothing. What is game? Who got game? Where's the game in life? Behind the game, I got game, she got game, we got game, they got game, he got game. It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but the game if it ain't saying nothing.
Damn, was it something I said? Pretend you don't see, so you turn your head. Race scared of his shadow, does it matter? Thought of reparations, got a plan with the population. Nothing to lose, everything's approved. People use, even murder's excuse. White men in suits don't have to jump. Still 1,001 ways to lose with the shoes. God takes care of old folks and fools, while the devil takes care of making all the rules. Folks don't even own themselves, paying mental rent to corporate presidents. 1 out of 1 million residents be a dissident who ain't kissing it. The politics of chains and whips got the sick missing chips and all the championships. What's love got to do with what you got? Don't let a win get to your head or a loss to your heart.
What?
Nonsense perseveres, prayers laced with fear. Beware, 2 triple O's
near. It might feel good, it might sound a little something. But damn the game, if it don't mean nothing. What is game? Who got game? Where's the game in life? Behind the game, I got game, she got game, we got game, they got game, he got game. It might feel good, it might sound a little something. But the game, if it ain't saying nothing.
Something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
Telling me I got to beware. It's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody, look what's going down.
Thought I'd
fat millennium just be killing them. And that's scary, like lies buried in a library. When did the state pen correct anything? When piles of us still be catching the bus. When stacks of cats packing laundry mats. Pay the preachers back, but where the teachers at? I ain't even gotta ask it. And who's underpaid that got fouled at the basket? I can't blame the envy at who be getting all the Benzies and taking them grants for granted. Last I checked, pyramids wasn't built like projects or in them government checks. Modern day thugs ain't got no guts. Pardon the expression under governor nuts. Last time in the church be the last time in the church. Dead pledged allegiance to CDs and movies. Leaving reality, believing fantasy. Bleeding fatalities, too many formalities. Prayers laced with fear, beware. 2000 is here.
It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but damn the game if it don't mean nothing. What is game? Who got game? Where's the game in life? Behind the game, behind the game. I got game, she got game, we got game, they got game, he got game. It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but the game if it ain't saying nothing.
Hotep, my sisters and brothers, good afternoon and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. I am so happy to be here with you this evening. It's Tuesday evening, October the 1st, 2019. Tonight we are going to prepare ourselves for a discussion and talk as it relates to our community and politics. The great Malcolm X says that politics without economics is like a symbol without substance. So tonight we want to talk about politics as we prepare to embark upon this electoral activity and campaign that's coming up in the next year or so. And we want to just kind of see where is it that the African-American community can line itself up, what are the possibilities for us, you know, how do we begin to think about that? So I'm happy to have you join us. This is the timeforanawakening.com network, timeforanawakening.com network, which is also a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. And we are happy to be here. This our program, the Black Reality Think Tank, is sponsored by Motherland Media Network, which is a dynamic format and program. There are other programs on our network as well. We're going to talk a little bit about that, the Black People Matrix that comes on. So I'm going to give you dates and times for those programs in just a few minutes. But first of all, I just want to kind of give our introduction. You know, as our program is produced by the Sankofa Historical Society, and we dedicate ourselves to those great, beautiful, and powerful ancestors whose shoulders that we stand. Marcus Garvey said, "Up, you mighty race. You can accomplish what you will." We also stand on the shoulders, and we are here. Our program is sponsored to the spirit of people like the great Fannie Lou Hamer, who taught us the morality of remembrance. She said that there are two things we should care about and never forget. Never to forget where we came from, and always praise the bridges that carried us over. And the great Malcolm X says, who taught us the instructiveness of history, saying that all of our studies, history is best prepared to reward our research. History is best prepared to reward our research. And then to the great Mary McLeod Bethune, who taught us our mission in education, saying we must discover the dawn and share it with the masses and bring the benefits of science and knowledge to those who need it most. The great Paul Robeson said that who taught us that the battlefront is everywhere. There is no sheltered rear. And the educator, Anna Julie Cooper, who taught us that we must be done together, we must be done together as male and female, saying that there is a female as well as male side to truth, and those who do not honor it do damage to both female and male. And so that is the shoulders that we stand upon. That is our dedication in terms of our program and our dialogue. We are here every Tuesday from 8 o'clock Eastern to 10 o'clock Eastern time, and from 7 o'clock Central to 9 o'clock Central. And I have a co-host that's going to join me shortly. She'll be on about 8:30, quarter to 9, Ms. Bernice Williams. But we're going to have a dynamic conversation, as always, and we're going to look at talking. And this is a call-in format, and I'm going to give you the number in just a few minutes where you'll be able to give us a call and stress your opinion, ask questions. You know, we're always welcome, always welcome there. And so we look forward to you participating with us and helping us talk about this very critical area of politics. A lot of politics going on right now. And so I think the African-American community needs to be braced and understand how to handle that. As always, here on the Black Reality Think Tank, we give credit to our ancestors, as we have just done, but we usually focus in on someone specific. And we try to tie it into whatever the current subject is. And one of the topics that we often embrace is politics and economics. Last week we talked slavery and economics, but this week we're going to talk politics and economics. And so we are looking always at people that have impacted us, that have we are following in their path, who give us the example, the blueprint that may be well for us to follow. So today, I am going to talk about a brother. His name is Amilcar Cabral. He was also known as Abel Djassi. He was a leader in the struggle for independence in Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde. Cabral was a writer. He was what we call an agronomic engineer, and he was a Marxist nationalist. He was born on September the 12th, 1924, in Bafafta, Portuguese Guiana. His father was Juvenal Cabral. He was a Cape Verdean, and his mother, Iva Pinhel Ivora, was Guinean. In 1932, his family moved to Cabo Verde, and in 1944, he began work at the National Printing Company in that country. In 1945, at the age of 21, he received a scholarship to study at the Agronomic Institute in Lisbon, Portugal, graduating in 1950. During his time in Lisbon, he founded something called the Student Organization-Led Movement. It was centered on African nationalism, including a Center for African Studies and Activities. He married a Portuguese woman named Marie Helena Rodriguez. In 1952, Cabral returned to Bissau to work for the Agriculture and Forestry Service of the Portuguese Guiana. The next year, he was commissioned to conduct a government-sanctioned agricultural survey of the colony. After a year of traveling through rural Guinea, Amilcar Cabral became convinced that independence would be possible only through military engagement. Independence would only be possible through military engagement. So due to Cabral's anti-colonialist activities in 1955, the governor of Guinea-Bissau insisted he leave the colony, and Cabral moved to Angola to join the Movement for the Liberation of Angola, often called the MPLA. On September the 19th, 1956, during a clandestine visit to Ghana, Cabral, along with his half-brother, Luis Cabral, Julio del Almeria, Fernando Fortes, and Elise Turpin, founded an organization called the African Party for the Independence of Cape Verde and Guinea, better known as PAIGC. In 1960, with permission from President Kwame Nkrumah, Cabral established military training camps in Ghana for the PAIGC guerrilla forces. Cabral and the PAIGC members emphasized Pan-Africanism and the importance of building a rural national movement that would give rise to a stable, independent state. By 1962, PAIGC was involved in guerrilla attacks on the Portuguese government. Open war was declared on January 23rd, 1963. Cabral married his second wife, Anna Maria Cabral, in 1966. Cabral was also an outspoken advocate for Guinean independence in the international arena. His speeches and writings were widely published in his lifetime, with writings in England and the Soviet Union, among other countries as well. But in 1970, Cabral and a PAIGC delegation were granted an audience with Pope Paul VI to garner support for the revolution. In 1972, Cabral spoke at the 163rd session of the Security Council of the United Nations, asking for an observation delegation to assess the conflict between Portugal and PAIGC forces. By 1966, the PAIGC claimed control over 60% of Guinea-Bissau. After significant military victories in 1972, Cabral began formal preparations for an independent Guinea. On January 20, 1973, however, he was assassinated by PAIGC naval commander Inocio Cani and a Portuguese agent at the PAIGC headquarters in Conakry, Portugal. Cabral's assassination was a part of a broader attempt to establish a PAIGC leadership more conciliatory towards the Portuguese. There are many that believe that other countries had involved who were supporting the idea of more congenial attitude among the inhabitants with the Portuguese. The liberation movement continued with PAIGC leadership taking office in October of 1974 after democratic elections delivered PAIGC 90% of the popular vote. Amilcar's half-brother, Luis Cabral, became the first president of Guinea-Bissau. Amilcar Cabral, very powerful brother. Excellent liberation movement, has a lot of blueprint for other countries, small countries, small third world countries, and African independent nations that are clearly possible in terms of the idea of independence. So, so happy that, again, as I said, you're all able to join us here today. We're going to talk a little bit about politics. Politics without economics is like a symbol without substance. We are embarking upon this, preparation for looking at these electoral votes. You're going to hear a lot of blah, 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 and all kind of talk. You know, you're going to see a lot of things happen, both on the local, state, national level. And I think we as African people have to talk about it. And we have to do it in a think tank kind of concept, make ourselves understand. Because there's always that question about, you know, how relevant is voting? You know, what results do we get, particularly on the national arena? I mean, very clearly on the local level, there may be some things that you can point to, but it's still an area that you have to look at. We have to talk about it. We have to teach it to our community and to help them understand the whole concept of politics. Politics is basically about power. It's about power and the control of power. And so as you see the various movements and as you see the things that are going forward, you're looking at people struggling for power, and they are struggling to control. Some people define politics as the art and process of gaining, maintaining, and using power. Now, that is a political science definition that's used by a lot of folk. There is merit to that definition. So, you know, things like social capacity then is rooted collectively, into the group. So when the group has structural capacity, its organizational and its institutional ability to realize its will, even in opposition to the others, is strong. And so we have to ask ourselves consistently, as in terms of the African-American community, where are we? You know, where are we in that level? Where are we social? Do we have the economic power to back up political power in our community, not nation, in our community? Can we do it independently of other coalitions and groups that we work with and try to work with, can it be done? Those are questions that we have to look at a little bit, and we have to begin to sort of address as it relates to ourselves. So there are key concepts to being able to grasp Black politics. There's key concepts to grasp as a study, and even as a social process. And we do have to study it. We have to study it as a people, and we don't. Most of the time, it's studied by outsiders, and it's studied in a way to control us. That's what these big think tanks throughout America do. They study the politics of Black community. So we have to begin to define that ourselves. As we talked a couple of weeks ago about nation building, we have to begin to define our own selves and define what it is that we want and what we need in a sense. And that's kind of what we want to, you know, talk about together. Because you're going to always have conflict from outsiders. There's always going to be, because they're, again, wielding power. They're attempting to grasp power. So I'm going to, there's an idea and a concept that I have often believed as a student of history and as a teacher, as an educator, and working with young minds. And I've asked many folk to consider this. And that is the idea that the Black community, however you define what a Black community is always has been perceived as the idea of an eternal colony, that it is a colonial, it is a colony, and it is seen from the perspective of outside power with the ability to go in and control and extract resources. And there's a lot of argument. There's a lot of our ancestors that believed in that, in the whole idea. Du Bois, in his study of the Philadelphia Negro, looked at it as a colony type of situation. Alexander Cromwell and some of his ideas and thoughts did the same. So I'm going to play to you a very brief lecture presentation. It's not long. It's like 4 or 5 minutes, but he's explaining and defining the concept of an internal colony. He is a political scientist at Howard University in Washington. He is a part of our team that we've been doing research with there. And let's listen to what he says about internal colonialism. And then we'll come back and we're going to then talk a little bit, and we'll open up the mics and just kind of do a group discussion on all of this. So here, let's listen to this real brief lecture.
Before I give an example of how the targeting of police officers in Dallas and Baton Rouge are an example of the elements necessary needed in internal colonialism, I want to say that my thoughts and prayers are with the families and friends of those officers that were shot and those that were killed in the line of duty. And so as I was reading about the Baton Rouge sniper incident, I couldn't help but to think of the concept of internal colonialism that Robert Blauner wrote about in 1969, which it had its intellectual roots laid out by Martin Delaney in 1852 when he stated that African Americans are a nation within a nation, and then later by W.E.B. Du Bois when he stated that we are semi-colonial in nature, or that we are domestically colonized. And so in his writing, Robert Blauner, in Internal Colonialism and Ghetto Revolt, he states that there's three social symptoms that point to internal colonialism being the cause, okay? So number one, it's urban riots. Now, I would actually disagree with the word riots here. I would use the word rebellion, specifically because that the sniper killings were targeted and coordinated efforts, which suggest rebellion, while riots are when violence erupts with no real target. And so that's my argument on that. But anyway, continuing that, second would be cultural nationalism, or the idea that African Americans represent a nation within a nation, right? And this is easily demonstrable from the Back to Africa movement of Marcus Garvey to the more current Black nationalist movements centered around the Nation of Islam, and later with the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And then lastly would be ghetto control politics, where people in the ghetto want to take control of their lives and the resources in their communities. One of the main arguments against this theory is that it's hard to identify what colonizers are extracting from the Black community, right? However, internal colonialists would argue that there's two basic things that are being strip mined within the black community, and that's athletes and criminals. Okay, and so let's think about this: is that athletes make the National Football League and the National Basketball Association billions of dollars a year, while arguably destroying the motivation of young black youth to pursue education as a goal, so that they can pursue and put all of their energy effort into trying to be an athlete, which is by far least likely to happen in their lives. While Michelle Alexander, on the other hand, in her book, The New Jim Crow, would argue that the creation of the black criminal, with emphasis on the word creation, almost supports the entire prison industrial complex. And so these are the thoughts and ideas and examples that I would use in order to talk about this.
Okay. And I'm going to go to our board. I have some very good clear thinkers online now, and let's deal with the subject of internal colony. Because, and here's why this is important. Because if that's the case, and I know that there are critics that have torn that apart, and there are folks that still do it, but are these folks that are interested in defining from our own interests? And that's really what we have to look at. We have to understand how the community feeds into that industrial complex, prison industrial complex. Because if it's a colonial kind of structure, then it's understandable how it works. And so as we attempt to try to fight and change and create our things in our own interests, and we are met with such resilience from outside, looking at it as a colony is understandable. Because at that point, then, it interferes with some of the objectives of having the black community as a colony. And so that's kind of why this has to be discussed. And you have to discuss it in that way. And I'm going to, you know, I'm going to give some examples, too, because and one of the largest ones, for instance, is, you know, the as he said, the prison industrial complex. That's very, very, very powerful. Industry, and there's a lot of things that feed that. The drug and alcohol communities, particularly alcohol, and as you know how we are programmed in the African community with alcohol, these big giant breweries who target this cheap liquor to our communities, creating feeding homelessness, feeding domestic violence, feeding the separation of families, feeding into that violence that you see so much because everybody's high, or you know have been induced with these terrible products, and they are on every corner. And then when you try to stop, get in there and politically stop them, well, you're going to run into some serious problems because what they also do, while they're feeding that poison to our community, they also make very large contributions to several community focuses and programs and ideas to try and help. So you're going to run into that money issue that is obviously very clear and very powerful in the community as well. The cigarette industry, you know, smoking and blunts and a lot of the police shootings and killings are being done by police because of the colonial aspect. They understand the colonialism of it because, first of all, they know they'll be protected. And so it makes them easy to go in and be boisterous the way they are and do some of the things that we see police doing throughout black communities of America. And that's because they view it as a colony. This is a jungle. This is the jungle. We've been assigned to the jungle. And so we've got to go into the jungle and deal with it in the way of its nature. And these are not people or human. This is a jungle. And they handle it like that. Sanitation issues and picking up of trash and on proper ways. Well, what's the use of us cleaning the streets and doing all the things? Because they're just going to jack it up anyway. And when you look around, sometimes you have to say, well, yeah, that's true. I was riding down the street yesterday, and a lady in a Mercedes SUV riding down, and she just took a whole bag of McDonald's and tossed that thing right out the window over into somebody's yard in the black community. And, you know, and you ask yourself, why? Why would you do that? You know, what would you think? Can't you wait and get to a trash can and do that? But anyway, that colonial colony mentality has fed into our people. And it feeds into some of those things that we've looked at when, for instance, Africa was colonialized and what happens in terms of colonial mentality and decolonizing our minds, you know, as so many of our brothers and sisters have written about. But one of the things that very clearly, you know, as I said, all of this strikes at, you know, is that, you know, our ability, you know, to sort of deal with our own interests, you know, being able to develop our own interests as a political tactic. In fact, you know, another definition of power is a group's capacity to define, defend, and develop its interests. Do we do that in our community? Can we define, defend, and develop our own interests? Are we able to do that? So to define them is to obviously articulate and establish it. So if we define our own issue, we should be able to articulate and establish, you know, what it is that, you know, we do. And then it's also, and to defend it, we have to be able to protect it against outside challenges and to develop them and to promote expanded other interests. We have here in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, there is a community organization, as a community business that has been very instrumental in being a center for discussions and talks and giving the community an opportunity to come together and enjoy themselves, both family and individual. They have things like a daycare next door. They have restaurant. They have talks and so forth. Well, the city of Milwaukee decided to tear up the street in front of that business. In other words, to do some reconstruction. And obviously they would argue that we were doing something to help the community because we were reconstructed. But it's so done in such a way that it has taken them an extremely long time. It is also provided where you cannot get access to it. So when you drive, your car was always very limited in parking anyway. And so you would have to park a lot of times on the side streets and walk, you know, to the restaurant. But people did it anyway because they loved the community and they loved that business and loved the establishment. A brother, former firefighter, owned that business. And now with the construction, it is so bad, you can't even cross the street because you're liable to fall in a ditch. And it's been very difficult to get into the business. So as a result, the business is losing money and may very well have to look at making some serious cutbacks. We pray that it doesn't close. So the question I raised last night with a group of brothers that were sitting around talking is, how did you let this happen? How did this community allow the political structure of Milwaukee to come in there and tear that street up like that to the point that people would not have access to it, would not be able to go, would hurt that business in such a way that I don't understand. And maybe there are some things I don't know. We very clearly we agree there may be some hidden areas that we don't have privy to the information. But the way it looks, you know, and recently the newspaper, television station put an article in it saying, you know, what's going to happen to this restaurant? It's being destroyed by the construction of this street. So, our own interests, you know, obviously this facility and this activity is a very important interest to us. I mean, there have been dynamic discussions and talks, organizations that have used it as meeting places. It has been a training ground for doing all kind of things. And now it's under the threat of possibly closing. Those are the kinds of things that we have to ask ourselves about political power, being able to defend, define, and develop, you know, our own interests. And that's what we're looking at when we look at internal colony. Because as a colony, you that's not in your control. It's obviously in the control of the colonizer. Another concept that I think we also have to look at in terms of black politics is social change. And that is linked to the and rooted in what we consider to be social conflict, as a lot of political scientists believe. And that is the assumption here is that the U.S. political system is defined by contradictory interests, not simply by consensus, as the pluralists contend. Consensus or universal agreement on values is clearly impossible in a society that is wracked by severe race and class division. It is wracked by that. When you've got the kind of racial tension that we have in this country, it's very hard to come to any kind of consensus about anything in the political arena. The political struggle to break through these constraints and sort of reorder the society in a group's interest becomes the key impetus for social change. And so we have to ask ourselves, how possible is that? Are we asking candidates or who run for office, who even represent our area, to tell us how they would do that? Are we asking that question? And right now I'm just kind of completely omitting the national thing. I'm just looking at the local state politics, which is really has the greatest impact and effect on us. And so many political scientists and have looked at that in terms of studying various ways. One of the two of the largest communities that have had these kind of studies that are worthy for anybody who wants to respond to some of this is to look at the Chicago politics. And St. Clair Drake, the sociologist, has done a masterful job of spelling out, plus some others, during the Harold Washington campaign. There were a lot of things that were written on how successful that was able as a grassroots effort to be able to do that. So there are a lot of considerations that have to be given, you know, in terms of, you know, how do we change your community? And so there are some areas, and then I'm going to go over to our audience, that essentially explain political power. There are several areas that I want to just mention that do that. Number one is key positions in government. And I'm talking key positions in government. Things like being able to be responsible for hiring procurement officers and people who handle the procurement of a state or a local government. The voting strength, being able to measure that and understand how that operates. That's an area of political power. Another one is alliance. Community control. How much control do we have over our community? How many people can you stop liquor stores from opening up everywhere, in every corner, everywhere, all over the place? Can you stop these Arab stores from doing some of the things that they do, the disrespect they have to our children, our women? You have any control over that? You have any control about what type of police officers patrol our area? Well, that's an essence of political power, and obviously being able, you know, to do that. And have that. And then another one is the economic capacity, which is what we're here to talk about. What kind of money base, economic base, and I'm not saying money, do we have other than consumerism in our community? How many factories do we control, distribution centers do we control in our community? How many of that is possible? Those are questions that we have to. Because the economic structure has to be there. How many grocery stores do we own? Large grocery stores, stores that feed families, can offer opportunities and sales. You know, how many of those can we control? And again, like I said, I'm just asking these as we talk about political power and obviously changing. And then in terms of community organization, now I'm talking real community organizations, community organization that can step in and call together a conference that can address domestic violence on a large scale. How much of that can we control? How much of that do we have at our hands and can do it without having to worry about what we talk about and what you can't say and what you do say? Again, these are just critical thoughts. Another one, possession of the knowledge base. How many think tanks do we have in our community that are studying these problems in depth? They're actually studying poverty, but studying it from the African perspective, bringing in our own people to look at our own minds, great minds and sciences, to do that. How many are doing that? Now, our ancestors did this. When W.E.B. Du Bois called a conference together on the problems of the Negro, it was called the Negro Problem Conference. He brought in the good minds from the community, those who he knew that had studied, who had the logistical tactics to get to the root of a problem and solve it, who understood problem solving, who had a global perspective of things and how that could fit into what was being done and as we make suggestions. Garvey had the same process in UNIA. He brought in brilliant minds to do that. The Nation of Islam has its own educational centers where it trains its own thinkers to come in and look at the various issues that obviously focus on them. And then another one is coalitions and alliances with outsiders. And that has to be real careful. We align sometimes with folks that just do not have our interests at hand at all. It's just not there. Because it's devastating, and we sometimes align with people. I know back in the 50s and 60s, that whole Jewish question came about black folk aligning and working with Jewish people. And we thought that they were our friends, but in a lot of cases they weren't. In some cases they are. And as one scholar said, you had some Jews that did work well with some blacks, but not all Jews worked well with all blacks. That's not the way it happened. And so how do we build coalitions? Who should we talk to? I've always said, for instance, that we need to look at, say, maybe our Hispanic brothers and sisters more closely. I think we have some alliances there that we haven't embraced in a way that we need to embrace them. I remember my years in New York, for instance, living in certain areas of New York between the Puerto Ricans and African-Americans. There were times that we did work together in some areas, and then there were hostility zones to the point that we had Harlem, and black folks lived in what was known as Harlem, but the Hispanics chose to call it Spanish Harlem. And so they drew the division line that the Puerto Ricans would live over this side of Harlem, black folks would live over this side of Harlem. Now, they did interact together occasionally, things like music, baseball, which always has a way of tending to bring people together. But it wasn't together to fight for change and to fight sometimes the same problems that we had. So we need to line up our coalitions and a little bit better and do a better job of that. So community organization, as I said, is very powerful. And we need to be able to deal with that in a way. And then finally, there's another one that I think is what some political scientists say is the ultimate power, and that is the ability for coercive power, the capacity to pose one's interest, to physically factor out opposition under the cover of law, to be able to raise class or race will and interest to the status of law and to establish authority through the strength of the gun. Now, that's the deep one. That would be very interesting. And obviously that is one that has to be carefully studied in our own privacy among our own selves. The ultimate power, a lot of political scientists believe, is basically the state power, and which is rooted in control of the coercive apparatus, the police, the National Guard, things like that. That's in charge of the state. This, however, has turned to alternative power, and that's violence. It always has been used against us in a very violent way. Their interest as a people and outside of the government has always been very devastating. And so these are things that we talk about. We must talk about, and we must talk about them as we begin to look at speaking about political power and elections and who do you support and do you have some support and what should that support look like. And these are the questions that the politicians, even the African-American, a lot of African-American politicians don't know this history. They don't realize that they should be looked at in that way. The universities that we have are not in our control. So they don't always teach that. They don't always provide opportunities of training in the preparation of people that are going to run for political office. So the internal colony concept has some real strength. And it has enough strength that I think that we have to begin to address that as we talk for change. We have to find a way, it is in our own best interest, to make sure that we are not seen in that way. There are things that we have to do. And there are communities that have tried this over the years, you know. In New York, I remember they had the Ocean Hill Brownsville situation where they were trying to control who was allowed to teach their children and what they were allowed to teach them, as well as when they were allowed to teach them. And that was a very controversial system. It created all kind of problems. It set the teachers on strike against a lot of that, and it became, in a lot of cases, it was a very violent movement. But however, sometimes what it's going to require. You're going to have to fight to change. So internal colony, I think that's the question that I want to raise first of all to our audience. I see I have my co-host on, and I'm going to get to her a little later. But first, let me go and let's deal with the internal colony. Brother Pugh, I see you are on. What is your take on the Black community as an internal colony?
Yes. Hello?
Yes, I hear.
Uh-huh.
How you doing?
Definitely. We're an eternal colony. In fact, Margaret Mead, I believe she was talking with James Baldwin, and she was contrasting the attitude that Blacks have toward the police versus the Chinese. And she said the reason that there is tension between the Blacks and the police is that the role of the police, they've been an external force, and they, you know, their interests are adverse to ours, whereas the Chinese, they were actually policing themselves, and as a result, any decisions that were made by the police were always designed to advance the interests of the community. The final thing is that our challenge, yes, without question, we're an internal colony, and our challenge is to turn the internal colony into a community and to take this community and integrate it into a society, and to take this society and integrate it into an ecology. And actually, this discussion that you're having today, I've been calling this since the 1980s, cultural maturity. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like the difference between the attitude of somebody that just wants a job versus the attitude of somebody that wants to start a business versus the attitude of somebody that wants to build a community versus the attitude of somebody that wants to build a nation. What's happening now is that the kind of talk that you're doing right now is the kind of talk that leads to the building of a nation. That means that there's a maturation in us. By the way, just before I listened to you, I'm listening to some people in Baltimore.
Okay.
And that's what they were talking about. They were talking about, you know, in other words, they were saying, well, you know, we're beyond just knowledge about stuff. Now the question is, How can we manifest this in different institutions in our community, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So on. Let me just summarize it this way, my thinking. Yes, we're an eternal colony, and the challenge is to become a community. I would say that in order to do so, everything that you've talked about since you've been on can be summarized by this concept I have called liberty and justice for all.
Okay.
In order to have liberty and justice for all, one, you have to have what Martin Luther King called the beloved community.
Okay.
And once you understand that, then that all of these issues about, you know, self-definition and so on.
I've heard you talk about that. Why don't you explain that?
Right. And then finally, the second part of liberty and justice for all is that you have to have the four freedoms. So all the talk about defense and development and so on, those are the four freedoms. And so once you have both of those, a beloved community with the four freedoms, then that means that you're a whole people, and therefore you have the potential now to show other people how they can be a whole people. And that's one of the problems we have in our society today, is that it's been oriented toward empire in the beginning, which had no intention of advancing the interests of the people who would be conquered. And our challenge is to essentially deconstruct that model, that Alexander the Great or Plato type nonsense, and to show them what it's like if you had a society that was part of a sacred world, as opposed to a society that's just part of an empire.
Okay, all right, I like that, Sister Yan. What do you think? Black community is an internal colony. Sister Ayan, are you there? Okay. Brother Timothy, is it an eternal colony as far as you see it? Because Du Bois started his work in that area using the Philadelphia Negro.
Well, my brother, I'm happy you came to me, and I'm happy Mr. Pugh, he gave us the steps. I'm going to give you the people.
Right.
So we have to go, like Malcolm taught us, what the messenger taught him, that history is the best study of our research. And remember, sir, in the non-violent civilization, we had politics. And we had the Egyptian mystery system. And everybody that wasn't allowed in the Egyptian system that looked like themselves.
Right.
So if we take it now to today's time, I like the way you look. You use Cabral. And I like the way that you use, that I'm going to talk about, Che Guevara. Because mm-hmm. they believed in the bullet and not the ballot.
Right.
And even take it further than that. I'll take a Philadelphian who was a great man who used a sense of government, was inside of government,
right.
Was Leon Sullivan. Leon Sullivan used his church as a government, and he had what he needed in that church. That church developed a bank. They had Progress Plaza. They had the Sullivan Principles. They had their own community. We had a public school that was basically black, and he was situated on a public school system. He was involved politically and socially. We socialized with each other. And I'll even take Barry in D.C. Barry in D.C. showed you what a P.G. County, which was one time black, would do. What he did as a mayor, he had summer jobs. He had youth camps. He had tutoring centers.
Right.
He had what we should be doing in a black community. And we've got to be easy to talk about Harold Washington. So this concept of us being colonized is how you define freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, we're not in chattel slavery. If the chains are on your mind, it's up to you to break it. Me running for office, had my own organizations. The mayor, a white mayor, okay, Mayor Rendell, had heard about me. He would come and open up my events. My children's festival dedicated to the parents,
right.
And my conference on education discourse. And people told me, you know, he's about that Muslim stuff. He's a nationalist. And Rendell said, but I like him. And when he came down here, he said, Tim, I'm happy to work with you. I said, why? He said, I can't bring Goldilocks in the black community. So that's true. So he gave me an award. And I said, you know what, Rendell? My cousin had to have been a commissioner under him, too, because that kind of helped. But I said, Rendell, you know, I'm here to help the black community. And he said, I heard about you. And I said, this is who I am. I said, I'm not. I said, they like me because if I acted other than them, they wouldn't trust me.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get these positions Why, you know, where's your mother then, man? Mm-hmm. If you went to Lincoln Howard, you went to Cheney, if you went to North Carolina Central, and all of a sudden you come out of that think tank thinking black, are you telling me you're going to let them mold you into a white man or a white woman? Well, you should be ashamed of yourself. You need to be in the Hall of Shame and not the Hall of Fame.
Okay. Okay. I like that. You're listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. My name is William Rogers. I'm your host. We're here every Tuesday evening from 8 o'clock Eastern Time to 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central, 9 o'clock Central. We are discussing the politics of the black community. We're using a quote from the great Malcolm X that says, "Politics without economics is like a symbol without substance." And we are looking and we're discussing right now one of the first aspects of that, which is the whole idea of the black community as an internal colony. And we wanted to look at some of the wisdom that comes from that. And it was actually seen by our ancestors in the same way. This is a call-in format. You can call us here at area code 215-490-9832. Just call us and we'll recognize the number, and we can either, as I said, say something or ask a question. Our program is sponsored by Motherland Media Network, which also sponsors a program called African Perspectives. And it's hosted by Brother Osieme Adelabu, who is the executive of the Motherland Media System. And he comes on every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. Eastern to 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Central to 12 noon on the Central Time. And then also following him is another program called The Black People Matrix with Brother Franklin Jones. And it's a dynamic program that comes on from 1 p.m. Eastern to 3 p.m. Eastern every Monday and Wednesday. And then on Friday, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard have a dynamic talk program that comes on at 8 p.m. Eastern called African Perspectives. Time for an Awakening. It's Time for an Awakening. It comes on Friday afternoon at from, as I said, 8 p.m. Eastern to 10 p.m. And then again on Sunday from 7 to 10, Time for an Awakening. Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Dynamic guests from international community that he has. And really enjoy some of the work that they did. And they are also, Brother Richard is the executive for the Time for an Awakening Network, and so we're happy to be a part of that. And by the way, the Black Talk Radio Network is the number one black podcast in internationally. And so I'm very happy to be a part of that and reach out to that broad audience. So give us a call, folks. We want to hear from you and bring in some thoughts that you might have about the idea right now of, as an internal colony. Brother Griffin, I really would like to hear from you. Do you see the black community as an internal colony?
Oh, I'm enjoying this. As a matter of fact, I'm headed down to the ADOS inaugural conference, and that's actually kind of the focus of what's going on at that conference.
Okay.
I see exactly as you said. It's very informative. I'm loving it.
All right. All right. Yeah, because you see it. I mean, it's all around us. And then, as I said, we don't have the political power to change
you off, but I'm pretty old, too. And I heard Brother Pugh chime in and said he's been saying it since the 80s, so I know I'm not alone.
All right. Exactly. Yeah. Very good. Thank you. And I know the two of you are very strong political. I love your Facebook posts that you do. You give us a lot of insight on some of these areas. Actually, you were the one that really put me in tune to informing what Kamala Harris had done in the past. I knew some of it, but I didn't know it into the depth that you provided. So keep doing that, by all means. Please keep doing that.
I'm an abolitionist. That goes back to the Black Talk Radio Network with Scotty Reed and Max Pothas. I give them credit for that. After hearing them, I actually started doing more and more research, asking questions. I kept wondering and wondering. And I love this internet thing. I hear younger people talk about it can be a mess, but I think it's like most technology, is what you do with it.
Right. And brothers and sisters, we have to use these formats in the best way we can to educate our people. We have to help them to understand, and particularly the political, economic realm of things, because it does impact their families, it impacts their community. It's destructive, it's sneaky, it's quiet, and so we don't want to our people to get lost in all of that.
Only other thing I'll say before you let me go is one thing I've learned after about 7 years on this platform is people have to learn not to take an idea personal. If you can't interrogate an idea and then let it go if it makes no sense, there's not something wrong with it. That put it up, there's something wrong with you. I don't get offended when people don't agree with me because we need to have these discussions, because even in the thing that's wrong, you learn exactly what not to do. So I don't understand when people turn it personal. That I'll leave it there.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you. Area code 336-621. Is that you, sister? Yeah.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay, right. I hear you, because I had called you before and I didn't hear you. Yeah, okay. What do you think? Well, we have an internal colony in the black community.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
And as usual, you know, the information that you're sharing and the teachings are just powerful. I really would like to see us do more, us all, especially those of us that are regulars on the show.
Right.
To really spread the word about Black Reality Think Tank and the other shows.
Thank you.
This very constructive. This is very, very important to be properly informed.
Right.
And you help to teach me that, you know, and you do that. You do that and you do it well. So we need this. We really do.
Right. Thank you.
So I was thinking of a couple of points.
Okay.
One is when you talked about allies, when I was growing up in Brooklyn, black folk and Puerto Ricans were, depending on where, like you talked about Spanish Harlem and Harlem, but we understood that we were Africans. We all did, especially during the Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud period. Black folk understood that, you know, we were African. And, you know, because of the culture, unfortunately, you know, the larger culture has to tell us something that we believe in. So, you know, James Brown came out with the song and people started wearing dashikis and all that stuff. And, you know, we were proud of who we were. And there was a level of unity in mind. And the Puerto Rican brothers and sisters in the community, we were very much united. They understood, you know, who the European was. If you think of in terms of, you know, being the oppressor. If you think of the last poets, the first group of last poets, Felipe Luisiano, I think his name was, his brother was Puerto Rican, and he did some dynamic poetry.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Yeah, so we had those relationships. You listen to salsa music and whatnot, Cuban, Puerto Rican, Brazilian, they talk about Africa. You know, in the music, so they know who they are. We are just so divided and fragmented. So, you know, I want to talk about unity because, as I've said many times, the things that we talk about that we need to do and in examining our situation and assessing it, you know, there was a time when we did build our own towns all over the nation. You know, I just learned of a place in Winston-Salem where I was born, where there was a plantation, and then after post-slavery, you know, that place, the area turned into a booming black. They were booming economically in every other way, like many areas did post-slavery. And so we've done it before.
Okay.
But we did it when we had no other choices.
Mm-hmm.
And now, so we had unity. We knew who we were, and we did what we needed to do. in terms of, you know, being self-determined, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. I like those three D's that you said. What is it, self-determination, development? What was that?
I know what you're saying.
Okay. So anyway, so we have models, we have examples, and the more, you know, you can just talk to, I mean, we can just talk to people, and they'll tell you about areas that were black and just well-developed.
Right.
And so it comes back to the question, we've done it. Now I'm not talking about ancient Egypt or ancient Kemet. I'm talking about South. I'm talking about New York, Chicago. Why can we not do that again?
That's exactly right.
Even the 60s and the 70s, we practiced nationalism. And what Brother Timothy talked about with Reverend Sullivan, with OIC.
Oh, yeah, right.
Fantastic. You know, I mean, he went to Africa, if I'm correct, and was doing work there. So why are we not doing that now? And, you know, I talk a lot about internalized oppression and menticide. You were talking about alcoholism and drug addiction and all of the traps that they set in these internal colonies. And just all of the tricks that they play on us, and we just fall right for these things. And so when we rise up, you see the pattern of them doing things to shut us back down.
Right.
And so we got to address that issue. We got to address some very specific issues. So in terms of, you know, we can't do anything, nothing without unity.
That's right.
And we do not have unity.
Right.
So, that's something that has to be addressed on a national level with black folk. And I have an idea, which I'm going to be sharing with people in the near future.
Okay.
And we can unify with our brothers and Hispanic-speaking brothers and sisters. That is possible. They've had their same brainwashing, but a lot of them are conscious now. So that can be undone. You know, some of that division can be undone. And the other thing I want to talk about, and I hope I'm not jumping around, but I got to talk about consequences. You were going to say something, Doc?
No, not at all. Mm.
Okay. I want to talk about consequences because part of what's going on with some of us is racial battle fatigue is called. I think our people in some ways were tired of fighting. This is an ongoing fight. It never stops.
Okay.
And besides the marching and whatnot, there's not a whole lot that we do, like what was done, you know, in the past with Leon Sullivan, the Black Nationalist Movement, et cetera. So I think some of that is racial battle fatigue and menticide just setting in. Even if you can't beat them, join them mentality where, you know, we've just said we'll just go ahead and assimilate, you know, that hurts our unity. So we got to deal with the unity. But consequences. What happened to consequences? Why? And this is just a question that I'm posing. What happened to consequences? If, like, the situation that you talked about and where you are, where they tore up the sidewalk in front of the Bug Brothers building?
Yeah, that's right.
Where are the consequences?
Yes.
See, when black people, you know, did some harm to whites during Jim Crow, not only would that black person pay by being lynched, the homicidal mob would come back, the maniacal mob would come back and kill at least around 100 people in the area to make sure that you got the message.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do what he did.
Mm-hmm.
There were consequences, and there's always consequences.
That's right.
What we do, whether we rise up or fight back or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the question to our community, where are the consequences?
Right.
When they do this to this brother's business, that's deliberate.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely deliberate.
Yeah. So who are we boycotting? What business are we deciding not to support until they fix that situation?
Right.
Not just going to talk to politicians and, you know, trying to address it through politics, because that doesn't work for us.
Mm-hmm.
They give in one hand and they take back in another.
That's right.
That's pretty much what they do. So The only thing they understand are consequences. And we really are terrible when it comes to having them suffer consequences for the things that they do to us. And so I think that's another thing that we need to actually have a national dialogue about.
Sure do.
I was listening to someone talk about situations that happened in Starbucks, you know, when they arrested those two brothers. Then something happened, I think a black woman was harassed by someone at a Waffle House. You know, why are we still going to those places? Why are we still patronizing? Mm-hmm. These are some concrete things that we can do, you know, issuing out consequences if you do something to us as a people. But without unity, we're not going to do the things that are doable, we're not going to do.
Right.
So I'm going to suggest, because I plan on doing some work, and again, we'll be talking about it, to address our own minds. Because, again, if we don't heal our own minds, all of this stuff will just continue to be talking.
That's right. That's exactly right. And your point raises a lot of questions about what we started off the conversation with tonight, was the acquisition of power. Because politics is basically the acquisition of power. So if we are not able to acquiesce power to fight for our interests and for change, then what are we doing? Then do we have a political even agenda?
Let me mention this. Can I mention this, Doc?
Sure. No, go ahead.
So there was a sister in Vermont, I think, yes, where Bernie Sanders is from.
Right.
Sister in Vermont, and I probably shared this on some shows several months back.
Uh-huh.
Sister in Vermont that was elected to some political office where she had a significant amount of influence and power, and I'm saying in quotation marks. She was the only black woman elected to this particular position in Vermont, which is supposed to be very progressive. We've all heard that, you know, it's a progressive state and whatnot. So this woman gets elected, and as I said, she's the only black woman, and she is stalked, and she's harassed by this one white guy. And she's in a position to do some. She has excellent progressive agendas and policies that she wants to put into place, you know. And the white folk are all proud of, you know, what they did. Ooh, we got this black one here who can make all these changes. A white guy stalks her, threatens her so badly. And by the way, she's well educated, you know, and politically savvy. But he stalks her so badly for 2 years that he runs her out of office. No police officer helped her. Nope, the police department, rather, did not help her. None of her political allies,
right,
no one in her party or in her community, which was primarily white, helped this woman.
Mm-hmm.
She had to run for her life.
Now, that's ridiculous.
How do we address that? How do we address the brother that was elected mayor maybe of Alabama, someplace. I can't remember his name, but he had an African name, and he was murdered because he was talking about black power.
Yeah.
How do we address these issues? We talk about getting political power, but when someone conscious gets into these positions, then they, unlike us, dole out some consequences.
And see, that's my argument. We have got to answer those questions. And most of the times we run from them. We don't want to answer them.
Mm-hmm.
We won't answer them. We'll start talking about some kind of political party mess, which has nothing to do with anything. But those specific areas of our community, why didn't we ask that question to the power that was conflicting in that community? Why didn't we? I don't understand that. And even you know, let's take it a little bit further. Even when Obama was the president of the United States, and he was in the highest seat of power in the national politic as a theory, why didn't he address the senator that said his wife looked like, or she was shaped like a gorilla or something like that. I don't remember what the exact thing he said. Why didn't he deal with that? Then deal with that using the machinery in which he operated.
Exactly.
I don't understand that.
Exactly.
He's the president of the United States. He is the chief of the armed forces. You know, of supposedly the most powerful country in the world, and a man calls his wife a gorilla. Or whatever he's, what is that? Harry Reid. What did he say about Michelle Obama? Something about said something about her animal nature, something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And see, they treated Obama like a dog.
Yeah.
You know, they said all kinds of things about him. You know, the white racists came out in full. Oh boy, they came out.
Right.
Even before he moved into the White House, if you all remember, they wouldn't allow him. They lied about a hotel that all of the presidents stay in before they move into the White House.
Right.
You know, the way they before they furnish it the way that they want to, et cetera, move their families in. There's a hotel that every president typically stays in.
Right, I've heard that. Uh-huh.
And you, if you remember, they lied to Obama and told him that there were no rooms. And when the situation was investigated, there were rooms. Mm-hmm. And one foreign somebody, ambassador, somebody was staying in this hotel. They told the Obamas that the hotel was full with ambassadors. Mm-hmm. See, so yeah. From the very beginning, they said, you are a nigger, and we are going, you only can, we allow you to do.
Right. Okay, let me go here to area code 414-399. You have anything to call? Area code 414-399. Okay, just listening. All right. Let's talk a little bit about this political party stuff and what that really kind of look at. You know, and obviously one of the things that is rooted is a lot of it is historical in nature, and it has to be understood from the historical consequences of it. But first of all, the rationale for political politics, you know, Democrat, Republican, begins with the fact that the party is the key political structure in the acquisition and the exercise of state power. It is out of the party that you get your power to operate, because if a specific political party is in power, then they can run that state from that position. With the Democrats, you know, regardless of what the national scenery may look like, but they can control that. So by definition, a party is basically an opportunity. It's a political structure which is specifically designed to seize control or effectively participate in the state's power. And so within the framework of the party's focus, which is on the exercise of state power, African people, like other party members and or supporters, try to seek to use that party to achieve their group and personal interests. That's the way it's always been. So, and the benefits, the perceived benefits in participating in things like the Democratic or Republican Party policies are basically linked to being able to have some kind of say-so in state power, which is a vehicle to which one's interests are basically represented. You can get things done and changed and rules and regulations done if your party is in control of the state. And it is a means of becoming one's own group representative, an elected or appointed official. It's also an opportunity to determine or help to determine public policy. You begin to put rules and regulations in place that will help your community using that. And then obviously things like jobs, appointments, funds and money for your community can also be done because you are in control of that state political machine. And so African people have always, in America, we've always participated in party stuff, Democrat, Republican, or even, and then a lot of times we participate in some of the third party systems like the socialists, the the Green Party, the Progressive, the Communist, Libertarian Party, things like that. We even participated in that. But that was to no effect. We were not able to achieve any results or anything out of being able to do that. So as a result, I mean, it's worthy of discussion, but really in terms of benefit, it just has not shown or proven itself to have any. So it really doesn't have an appeal a lot of times. And so basically, African-Americans have been relegated to parties. Now, there have been attempts where, you know, African-Americans, we as African-Americans have attempted to try to create independent political parties, to try to do things like draw up an agenda or to show that unity purpose. I know one of the first ones was one called the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which my shero, Fannie Lou Hamer, was in, and you know she used it powerfully to upset the Democratic Convention when she demanded to be seated, you know, and got Lyndon Johnson to crumble down to making sure that something happened the way she wanted it to happen. And then there was, which is one of the first usages of the concept of Black Panther, was done out of Lowndes County, Alabama. It was a Black Freedom Party. The symbol was the Black Panther. And this was done pre-Oakland Black Panther idea. And then in addition to all these things, and these were attempts, again, to be able to sit down and write an independent agenda, put things in place, and then go to the ruling parties at that time and say, here, this is what our agenda, we want this to happen, and be able to do that as a unified force. And I think only for that Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, that's one of the only ones that I know that really was able to do that and to make some things happen in that way. But it does work well. It increases consciousness. It gets us together to talk about looking at things from an independent basis and so forth. One of the questions, you know, I've heard asked over and over is, how did Black folk get involved in the Democratic Party? What made us, you know, be in that? Well, history answers to that. Well, first of all, in the post-slavery, Blacks couldn't get into the Democratic Party. That was one of the reasons they were blocked from doing that. They were not allowed to participate physically. You could not join the political arena. Those were held by the good old boys of the South. And so you were blocked from getting there, so you had no other choice but, you know, to go to the Republican Party. So doing it, and then it was a lot of reasons. One of them was the party of Lincoln. And they were basically, looking at the idea of ending the captivity system. So that was exciting. And then Republicans did actively recruit Blacks, to build a Black electorate and to sort of fight against the Democrats. They literally did that. And then the other one is they financed, you know, a lot of those Black officials that were elected after Reconstruction or during Reconstruction were financed by the Republican machines at the time, which were coming out of those liberal communities. You know, the Republican Party was founded in Ripon, Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is that area where there were people all into the Enlightenment, you know, and things like that. And so it made it very easy and accessible. And then when in 1876, when Rutherford B. Hayes was running for his office, it kind of killed it, because one of the things that he did, he agreed to withdraw the federal troops that were in the South, which at that point leashed the Southern wolves, the Southern animals, out against African people. And that's one of the things that happened. They were able to do that in a very destructive way. So that was a bad, bad, bad move in terms of the republicanism idea. So the Compromise of 1877, which is where Rutherford B. Hayes agreed to do that along with some other things, just so that he could get elected. He was running against Samuel Tilden, who was more of a Southern supporter, And as a result, a lot of black folk at that point jumped ship and began to look more at the Democratic Party in terms of doing that. So that's a little bit of the history. It's not complete, but that's a little bit of how all of that took place and began to, you know, obviously operate in a way that, you know, made it possible, you know, for so many to come into the Democratic Party. So the historical tendency of blacks to vote Democratic, regardless of what the deal is, had a lot to do with the hostility from Republicans when it changed. A lot of the ideological orientation of the Republican Party was sort of opposite black interests at one time. It became the party of money and economics. And then obviously the conservative trend and the internal resistance to courting blacks and making the kind of concessions that our community required was real major area. So, you know, it's really important that we understand, you know, just how that worked, and which is why they jumped ship and did some of the things they did. I think as we began to, you know, try to understand today where things are, and that's one of the reasons why we've stayed with the Democrats so long, is because of the fact that we have, the Republicans have just been hostile, you know, in those early years. And so those party initiatives and things that they were doing. And then obviously when we decided to maybe form our own party, there has been ideas around that. And there were several attempts. And one of the biggest one was the Black Independent Political Party back in 1980. And so that it was in Gary, Indiana. And that's when a group of Africans, and particularly more toward the nationalist wing of things, decided, you know, to set up a, you know, an independent black party. And it was very interesting, that convention and what took place and what came out of it. I think it was vital. It did not create an independent black party, but it was vital to some of the things, and people are still calling for it today, that there is groundwork to sort of do that. One of the stronger versions of that was a party by that Ron Daniels attempted to try to pull together. And Brother Daniels did a magnificent job of bringing key figures together and addressing some of the issues. He himself even ran for president, you know, during some of that time and opportunity. But again, the question has to become, what was the benefit, you know, for the masses? And how was that going to begin to take place? So I think that's one of the other areas that we wanted to discuss is the party politics. And because that confuses us, really, it does. It's a very confusing issue and concept, and we get tied into that, and we think that that's the best interest. Right now, for instance, you've got the Democratic convention this year is going to be in Wisconsin, and a lot of folk are lining up, you know, to try to take advantage of that. I'm not so sure just what benefits there are going to be for the African-American community. Looking at the idea of what we had talked about before, is it being an internal colony, I don't know if it's going to be possible in any way to do that. So I'm going to take a break, and then we come back. We're going to deal a little bit with that whole idea of political parties and just how do we need to begin to look at that. So let's just take a quick break, and we're going to come right back and deal with have some things to say about the political parties.
We must die, let it not be like hogs hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs making their mock at our...
Sorry about that. So, okay, we are back. I want to go over here to our board and ask, I saw Brother Lance Jones was online. I wanted to ask him a question, but he did leave us. Sister Yan, did you want to talk a little bit, add a little bit about your perspective on political parties? Do they have a value in terms of our agenda setting in the political arena? What is your take on that? Sister Yan, are you there? Okay, let me ask that Brother Pugh. Brother Pugh, what do you think, Brother Pugh?
Hello?
Oh, okay, I'll come back to you. I thought you had gone. I was talking to you. I'll come right back to you. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, well, just briefly, yes, parties have a value today in 2019 in the short term, and the Democratic Party is just fine with me. I think in the long term, though, parties are not in the interest of human beings, and so we need to transition away to something that is more organic.
Okay.
And just one a little thing. Sister Ayan talks about menticide and whatnot. I have another concept that may be useful And it's like, you know, if you're a business, if you're running a business and you don't have a business plan, that is, if you don't really understand all the aspects of your business, there may be opportunities that you could take advantage of, but you're not aware that they would help or hurt your business. And that's the same way that Menticide works, is that if you're seeing yourself just as an individual, you're walking through life, there may be opportunities that you as a father, or you as a member of a community, or you as a member of a nation could take advantage of. But because of the fact that your mindset is limited to you just as a person, you essentially walk past it. So just wanted to throw that in.
Okay. All right. Let me ask you, Brother Timothy, is there a value for agenda setting for African people in terms of political parties?
Well, I'm going to do it like this, Dr. Rogers said. Now, I think I told you about my great-grandmother who came from the segregated South in Georgia, mm-hmm. and the other parts of my family came from Mobile, Alabama. The other ones came from Jacksonville, and they came up here in the segregated South in the mm-hmm. 30s. And I told you about my great-grandmother, Old Lady Collins, who carried a pistol. She was an Eastern Star. She okay. said, I carry my pistol because it didn't feel the bark and bite. But her son and her were in disagreement. And I said, why is that? And my great-grandmother told me as a young man, she said, I'm from the party of Lincoln. And her son, who was my grandfather, said that he became a Democrat because he saw the progressiveness of what the Democratic Party did under Roosevelt.
Right.
So I came to the conclusion that with both of them at their time and their progressiveness, that wherever you see a white man, you always find an Uncle Tom. And you got racists in Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Now, I'm going to go to Sister Ayan. She said something that's very important that a lot of people don't know. I'm going to get a copy of it. I'm going to save it. And I'm not going to never let it go. And Elijah Muhammad had a copy of the message to the black man. He circulated in Harlem. And it had Blanco Diablo, the white man is the devil. And Clarence 13X from the nation mm-hmm. had a following in his nation. And he had a following of Hispanic people and Spanish people. And it was really great. Mayor Lindsay supported in them. But one person in the message to the black man, Elijah Muhammad told us to back, was Adam Clayton Powell.
Okay.
He said that was a man
right.
who brought what they called back then the bacon to the community. And he's passed 67 pieces of legislation, war on property, CCP camps. So the value of politics, I'm going to get to the Independent Party, is important. And when we were working like that, if you know Abernathy's wife, you know Abernathy,
mm-hmm, right.
and you know how unfortunate she died, his work, and King working out of the church, you have these people. They bombed the church, killed those four little girls. That was right there was our haven, what we worked out of. That, like Sister Yon said, we got to be able to shut this stuff down when they come after us. But an independent party is important in Philadelphia. Let me give you an example. Right now, today, we just recently had a city council election. And we've had black mayors, congresspeople, council people, state reps, right? And we have 9 people on city council who are black, male and female. And all of my friends said, do they ever come to the radicals and the activists and ask us how we could help them? No. Now, we're all going to look on how they're going to vote. Now, they're going to tell, I'm going to give you a scorecard and tell you, being black, what they're doing for their own communities and schools that they came from. So independent party is important, Dr. Rogers. But what kind of mindset do we have? Are we thinking about our people, or we want a pension and a paycheck?
That's right. Okay.
I mean, come on, man. This is for real. You listen. You have a white supremacist, no good, lying, filthy, no good man. And he had his, it's not him, it's his party.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, Malcolm and King would go down to D.C. to try to get legislation passed. Philip Randolph, all those people. What is the Black Caucus doing in Philadelphia? What is the Black Caucus doing in D.C.? What is the Black Caucus doing in the South? What are they doing in the Midwest? What are they doing in California? And like the pamphlets,
You had Bobby Seals ran for mayor. All that's good. But when you get in there, what do you do for your people? And Booker T. Washington is the perfect example. He said, cast down your buckets with me, you are. It's almost you want to put Reconstruction with him, because he would have gave them the money to have what they need to continue to run, to give it back to our community, education, politically, and socially.
Okay.
But Dr. Rogers, today, we should be doing it ourselves. We got to start looking at ourselves, Dr. Rogers.
We have to.
That's all to
you
that.
Have to. And that's what our ancestors been saying. That's what Malcolm tried to say. That's what everybody said. You got to look at yourself. And I mean, how long are you preaching that before people understand it? I agree. Let me go over here to 404-573. How you doing today, my brother? Area code 404-573.
Yes. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much. I have just tuned in about 2 minutes ago.
Okay.
So I don't know what the discussion is.
Okay.
But I heard the brother speaking about 2 minutes.
Okay.
And I share to all of that. But we have not, because we ask not. We put these people in there 20, 30, 40 years, and we don't ask them for anything anymore.
That's right, yeah.
You know, we got to get on the ball and get to rolling and make some demands and make some changes. And we have to make some changes ourselves as well.
That's right. And that's what we've been talking about. The topic for today's discussion was using Malcolm X's quote, politics without economics is like a symbol without substance. And we've been looking at, this current electoral system coming up, this electoral season, and just where do African people need to be aligned? What is it that we need to understand? And very clearly, just what you said, we've got to ask hard questions and demand an answer and put everybody who is going to supposedly represent us, even though they may look like us, they're going to have to demand that they speak, you know, our gender. And we have to set that. And that's kind of what we're talking about. And so thank you.
May I ask, wasn't these Congress people just elected in 18?
Say it again. I'm sorry. Say it one more time.
The congressional representatives. Weren't they just elected in 18?
Yeah, I think I'm hearing you, understanding you correctly. You said the current group of, you said legislators, were they just elected? Is that what you were asking?
Yes, the Congress people and the...
Well, some were, you know, they served 6-year term. And so some were, I think there's some still up. Brother Griffin, do you have any information that you could share with our caller about that? What is the status for the African American?
Oh yeah, she's right. They get every 2 years on even years, but the Senate is every 6 years.
Yeah, Senate is 6 years, right.
Yeah.
So
she's perfectly right. As a matter of fact, the group I work with, we've been pressuring quite a few of them, about 30 out of the 46 or 47, I think, that are part of the Congressional Black Caucus. We've been on them for the last 4 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And see, so...
So it's still not too late to, you know, knock on their doors and interrupt their party.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's what we have to do. We have to do that. That's what the lobbyists do. You know, if they're trying to get something through, they go up there. I mean, they register. I would say they register the lobbyists, but, you know, you do have the ability to speak to a person that represents you in your district. You have an opportunity to talk to them. And if they refuse to talk, put them on Front Street. You know, and keep pushing that. That's the power. We started off our discussion tonight with the fact that politics is the acquisition of power, and to be able to do that then gives you the tools to fight politically. But you have to be able to acquiesce power in some way, and for us, it needs to be on a collective grassroots basis. That's the way it has always worked for us. It has not worked being a Democrat or a Republican. It's work being in grassroots situations. And we have to go back to that and or either implement that kind of thing on a local level, you know, and go from there. Because, you know, it's obviously starts at the state where you actually control the system from the state level. And then you move that on into the national level. And we haven't done that proficiently enough, even when we had a black president, supposedly, that you know, we were not able to meander that system in a way that got benefits for us, you know, and by demanding him, you know, we didn't demand Obama enough. And so, I don't know, that's the thing we're talking about and how to do that now in this season of electoral politics that are coming up now, you know, and I'm really speaking, as we're speaking on a local level and state level, you know, nationally we know what that's going to take, but locally and state, we got to control that too first. And that's kind of been the gist of our discussion today. So, caller, I appreciate it. 404, thank you for calling. Sister Yan, you want to add something? We only got a few more minutes left, but what do you think, Sister Yan?
Well, I just want to talk about my observation.
Okay.
And that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are two sides of the same coin. They are both controlled by corporations, and they're not going to work in the interest of the people.
Okay.
They're dismantling every kind of protection for natural, for our water, our air. I mean, they're just doing so many destructive things, so many destructive policies they're putting into place, and they're rogues. They do what the hell they want to do. So I would like to see black folk really take a strong look at reality, because demanding and pressuring and whatnot, you know, it's just not getting us anywhere. I'm living in a neighborhood right now, and a lot of times when I talk, you know, I'm angry because this summer I've had my door open. The air is filthy. My air in my area smells like rotten eggs.
Mm.
My water is so awful that it's a orangish color. The water where I am in North Carolina, which used to be clean many years ago,
right,
is now so full of pollutants that is almost undrinkable.
Right.
And on a local level or any other level, no one is doing anything about this. And it's Flint is bad, Newark is bad, and the same thing that's happening in those areas are spreading across the nation. Politicians are not going to protect the elements that help us to live. So why we keep expecting anything from them is just doesn't make any sense. The whole system.
Well, what do you suggest, sister?
Let me say this.
They are there to serve.
Let me finish quickly.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
The whole system, from my view, needs to be dismantled. It's rooted in racism. And I went to listen to Reverend Barber. He was here in Greensboro last night, and he had his moral movement going. And there were all kinds of people, black, white, they had the LGBT, everybody was represented. And the place was packed. So they're actually doing good works. But they finally came to the conclusion, the first time I heard a movement like that say that they actually had to fight, and they're not going to preach this passive resistance anymore. So that was a positive, because what I'm experiencing, this whole system has to go.
Okay. Carla, you wanted to add to that? Okay.
Yeah. That's what it's going to take. And you're going to have to demand that, and they're going to have to listen or organize to remove. I mean, the system itself is not going to crumble, because that is the Constitution. That's the way these policies, this operation, this corporation works. So what we need to do is organize and demand.
Mm-hmm.
Actual demand. They're doing that in Japan right now. They've been on 17 weeks. Now, that's just probably the first one of the steps that we could take. But we have to do something, and dismantling, I think that's sort of against the Constitution, if they even believe. They don't believe in it anyway. But it's what, you know, step by step, we got to take a lot of steps at the same time. But like you say, all of the community was represented, the LGBT, the Caucasians, the blacks, the poor. So when it comes to a broad-based issue such as our air, I'm going to finish in 2 seconds, our air, our water, mm-hmm. and our earth, these are things that they have to protect if we make enough protests and focus about attention about it. Mm-hmm. Thank you, dear sister.
Right.
Thank you, sister.
Yeah, I agree. You know, Frederick Douglass told us that power conceives nothing without demand. And so you obviously have got to use that as a part of our political agenda. You have to demand answers. And
consequences, Doc.
Right.
If there are no consequences, they'll continue to dismantle everything. They don't care whether we breathe or not.
That's true. All right. Immediately preceding this program tonight is the Warren Valentine Show. So for those of you who can stick around, we invite you to listen to Warren Valentine immediately after our program. We are at our close. We thank you so much for your discussion tonight and participation and for joining us. So we'll be back again next Tuesday at 8 o'clock Eastern Time right here on timeforanawakening.com. Have a very productive week, and we look forward to seeing you on next week.
Black as you, black as me, black as us, black as free. Black as me, black as me, black as us, black as free. Black as us, black as me, black as us, black as free. Black as free, black as me, black as us, black as free. Black as you, black as me, black as us, black as free. Black as me, black as me, black as us, black as free. Black as us, black as me, black as us, black as free. Black as free, black as me, black as us, black as free. Black as you, black as me, black as us, black as free. Black as me.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.